welcome back to Halftime. Shorter, more topical episodes of Pastor's Pregame that you can listen to in about half the time. This is the second of three conversations Bruce and I had on sexuality and gender. In this one, Bruce gives us what he believes is a biblical theology of sexuality. All right, everybody, we are back for another episode, and these are some special summer episodes that we're doing. We're pre-recording so that while Bruce is out on his vacation and study break, we have content for you guys. So we decided, you know, why do something mundane and boring? Let's just blow it out and do something potentially horribly controversial.
I hope not, Lisa.
We're trying to be very careful, but we do want to address a topic that is big, that is everywhere in our world right now, and that is human sexuality. And how do we as Christians steward our own sexuality well? And also, how do we think about what is our posture towards those who don't agree with us? And how do we ultimately, our goal is, as Bruce said in the last episode, is to be more like Jesus.
That's right. And if these are only short episodes, and if this is a topic you're interested in, our church leadership team, our pastors have just set the calendar for next year and have decided to do a seminar on a Saturday, 6-hour seminar on Saturday, September 30.
And then also, we should talk about digging deeper this summer. Bruce wrote a book called
Leading a Church in a Time of Sexual Questioning.
I'm so sorry. I always mess up the title, so I just let Bruce say it rather than mess it up. But yes, Leading a Church in a Time of Sexual Questioning.
I've just talked with a publisher about redoing the book and said, I really don't like this title and nobody can remember it. And they said, I know. I don't know how we all got this title. So there might be a revision in a new title, but I can't promise anything.
But Bruce is going to be reading that book alongside. It's going to be a book study with the author, which is super cool. How often do you ever get to do that? So it's going to be 3 weeks during the summer.
Yeah, actually 6 weeks. We're going to meet every other week.
Three sessions.
And you can read the book in advance and we'll get together and talk about it a third at a time and just have an open conversation.
And the first one of those is July.
The first one is going to be July 13th.
July 13th. And all this is on the website. If you under Digging Deeper, you can find it and register for it. So yeah, I think that will be so great for people who want to dig into this topic more deeply, but also have conversation. I mean, there's tons of content out there, but I think what can be really valuable is just getting around a table and talking about this.
That's right.
Because it is such a difficult thing to talk about without feeling like you're going to say something wrong or something that's going to hurt someone's feelings or offend somebody. And also, I will put a couple of books in the show notes for you guys. One of them I really like is by Preston Sprinkle, and it is Love.
People to be Loved.
People to be Loved. Yes, thank you. See, I'm bad with all titles, so don't retitle your book because of me, Bruce. So yeah, let's dive back in. If you didn't listen to the last episode of the podcast, I'd go back ahead and listen to that first because it kind of sets the tone and we define some terms, and I think that's really helpful. And just to reiterate, I'm going to ask Bruce some tough questions because I want to represent you, our listeners, well. And so I've tried to come up with questions from all perspectives, whether that be somebody who is very affirming of gay marriage or someone who is very, very not affirming of gay marriage that holds to a traditional sexual ethic. One of the questions I think that came from our last discussion of all the different terms, we talked about, you know, non-binary and sexual orientation and gender identity and all sorts of things, is should we be using those terms? Because one of the sort of more strong traditionalists that I read was like, I just reject all those terms. I think the only terms we need to use are biblical terms, which are sin and what God's design has said. I don't think we need to, I think it's worldly for us to use that language. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I think I can hear behind that question, I think some appropriate caution that we would be living moral lives, holy lives, biblical lives. However, it betrays I think there's some fear behind it probably, but it betrays a false understanding of language itself. Mm. It's funny, a lot of people treat the Bible itself as if it was special language, like holy language, or it's written in sacred language. But the Bible was actually written in everyday language. So the kind of Greek it's written in is called Koine, K-O-I-N-E, which means common. It was the common language of the day. It wasn't a special language. It wasn't religious language. And so today we treat it a little differently. And so Jesus came to communicate in the language of his day. Mm-hmm. He spoke Greek and Latin and Aramaic. Aramaic was often the language used around that time. And so I think we should use the language of our day to communicate with the people of our day.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, even the word gospel is, we think of it in purely religious terms, but right. It was actually sort of a, it just meant good news.
And
it was often a political term, meaning like good news from the government, from Caesar.
There was recently a victory.
Yes.
It's like we might see something in Ukraine and go, oh, they won a victory. There's good news today about Vincent or Ukraine. And that's what they would say.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I think that's an excellent point. But again, I agree that we want to recognize that with naming things, you're defining them in some sense. You're at least setting parameters around the conversation in how you name something. So I think just being aware of that, of who's setting the terms and what those parameters are in our conversations. But we always want to do all our discussions of this in love, because although we will talk about, and we're about to jump into something that's kind of more broad, we're going to talk sort of God's design, sort of the whole story of the Bible. Bruce is going to give you in like 3 minutes. But we also recognize that we're talking about individual people too, that this is not just some sort of position paper or just sort of some sort of abstract, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin discussion. These affect people deeply. The way we think about sexuality affects real people. And so we of course, both of us come from that posture as well. Okay, Bruce, give us the 3 minute breakdown of how this started and how this all went wrong.
Yeah, sex in the Bible. When I started studying this topic, I realized, hey, far above LGBTQ is a biblical theology of sexuality. I never studied that. That wasn't a topic at my seminary, in my courses. But there are a couple of good evangelical theologies of sexuality that helped me get, I read the ones that are out there that I'm aware of, get a bigger perspective. And I realized, you know what, as evangelicals and growing up in Bible churches myself, our view of sexuality is really thin. It goes something like this. Here's a promise ring. Don't have sex until you're married. True love waits. And then when you get married, the wedding night will be amazing. And then once you get married, do it really good. Here's a bunch of Christian sex manuals.
Yeah, and have babies.
Yeah.
Have lots of babies and build more families.
Books and, like Intended for Pleasure and The Act of Marriage. And there's lots of ones out there that, and so I thought, wait a minute, what really does God say? And I went back, a good way to study any topic in the Bible is to go back to or look at it, Genesis to Revelation, or simpler, in the history of God's work in the world, which you can divide into four big chapters, the creation, the fall, where it all went wrong, redemption, and then new creation. How's it going to be in the end? So I thought, let me look at sexuality through in each of those chapters, so to speak. And it was fascinating because you see different things. So in creation, we learn sex is good. God created us, man and woman, to multiply, which implies Adam and Eve had sexual relations, as a married couple. So we learn that sex is good in marriage between one man and one woman. So sex is designed for that context. I like Tony Evans, who uses the illustration that fire is great in a fireplace. If you have it in other parts of your house, really bad. And I think the same thing. Sex is wonderful in marriage between one man and one woman. Then in the fall, sex is distorted. But it's distorted for everyone. And it's so easy to think that somehow if I'm straight and married, that my sexuality is good. I can put a check mark. I'm righteous sexually. But those people who are gay are not. And if people are single and they're over 30, I'm a little nervous about what they're doing with other urges, so to speak. However, I think we need a little more understanding that we're truly, of course, we're all sinners. I really think post-puberty, we're all, or let me say 99.99% of us are sexual sinners. So you start thinking through all the things that have gone through your mind sexually, or things you've done before you're married or you're doing right now. including pornography and cheating and emotional affairs and all the things.
Well, and including in marriage.
Yeah, so then let's go in marriage, because I find people say, well, gosh, if I'm straight and I'm married and I'm not having an affair and I'm not watching porn, I'm good. I go, well, and I'm saying this to press the point, y'all, for us to think about ourselves. In marriage, have you ever used sex as a reward or a weapon? You better not, or you're not going to get some, or if you want some, you better. Is all the sex in your marriage utterly unselfish? Have you ever tried to coerce or force or persuade or manipulate your partner?
Yeah, truly consensual.
Yeah, to do something they didn't want to do, or when they didn't want to do it, or how they didn't want to do it. And this goes on all the time in marriage. So you begin to think, is any of your sex in your marriage truly, purely loving, unselfish, all for the other person? Truly 1 Corinthians 13 kind of love. You're like,
Well, I don't, I think sometimes you overstate that, but okay.
Sure. You've heard me say that. And my point really is to say that there is sexual sin even in marriage.
Yes. It's definitely possible.
And I would say that as I counsel people through the years, very few married couples are happy with their sexuality. For one reason or another, both people aren't always happy. That doesn't mean there aren't couples. There are other couples that are, it's all wonderful. But the point is that we are all sexual sinners. And so we need to have sympathy, empathy for each other, awareness that it's so easy to stand up on a stool and look down with self-righteousness at those other people who are bad sexual sinners as if you were not. And so I think, what does that mean for us practically? We ought to look at our own selves. It's Jesus look at the log in your eye before you look at the splinter in your brother's eye. And on this issue of LGBTQ, I find some people saying, well, you should just stop it. Like if you're a male and you're attracted to males, or just a female attracted to females, stop it or change and change so that you become heterosexual. So let's just push that point a little bit. Does the Bible say you should be heterosexual in all your desires? Well, it really says you're to be unisexual. Here's what I mean by that. I'm being a little cute with the phrase uni. It means one. You're to have sexual desires for your spouse and only your spouse. So if you're a man and you have desires or are romantically attracted or erotically attracted to women who are not your wife, that's wrong. Why don't you stop that? Quit being attracted to a woman in a bikini. You're like, well, I can't do that. Well, that's the point, is we're to not sin. It's not that our attractions or desires change. It's our maturity is that we don't act on them. We don't give ourselves into lust or sexual behavior that's inappropriate.
So what you're saying is back to what you said in the last podcast, which is there's a difference between temptation and sin.
That's right.
And so your sexual orientation in and of itself is not sinful. But what you choose to do with that, what you choose to do with your sexual desires, can lead you into sin.
And so all of us need to restrain our sexual desires. None of us should act on all the sexual desires that run through our heads. All of us need to exercise self-restraint in our minds and in our actions, and in order to live holy, righteous lives before the Lord. Now, in redemption, what happens? Well, in redemption, interestingly, singleness is honored. And I really didn't ever see this before, but in the Old Testament, there's all these stories of finding a wife for somebody, overcoming infertility for Sarah, and the promise of the seed that would come. And then in the New Testament, the seed comes. Jesus Christ is the promised one to come. And after that, there's very little about marriage or parenting or having children in the rest of the New Testament. And there's very little about married couples who are ministering for Christ. But there's tons about singles. And in fact, 1 Corinthians 7 talks about the value of singleness. Jesus himself was single, and in eternity will be single. So I realized, gosh, I've underestimated the value of singleness. And I think generally the evangelical church has undervalued single people, seen them as almost second-class citizens, or it's a lesser desired state to be single than to be married. And I think that's been a big mistake. It's equally fine to be single or married. And then in the new creation, what happens? In the new heavens and new earth, Jesus says, we'll be like the angels and neither marry nor be given in marriage. Since all sex is for marriage, that means there's no sex in the new creation. That's shocking to a lot of people. Like, wait a minute, I thought heaven was supposed to be good. I don't even want to go there anymore. No, we misunderstand. in what's really good. Because what are we looking forward to? What's the great goodness of the new creation is that we'll be united with Christ, who is our groom as the church is his bride. And we will see him face to face and know him as he is. And knowing God, being united with Christ, will be better than sex. The union with Christ, intimacy with the Lord, is better than sex. And that's true not only then, but today too. And when we can understand that sex has its place, it's a great gift, it's a terrible God. That life without sex is not a deficient life. Life without Christ is a deficient life. You can live a great life, Jesus did, and never have sex.
Okay, so what you're saying is that for people who are gay, does that mean that there was something fundamentally wrong with them? Or that they are somehow disordered, or because this is what I hear, right? I understand everything you just said, and but I think when you're sitting down with someone and you're talking to them one on one, and they're saying I'm gay, I have this attraction for someone of the same sex, and you say, well, yes, that's a result of the fall. So what, and it seems to go against, in their mind at least, which is, this is not just a Christian message, this is the cultural message that's enforced as well, which is that you were just born this way, that this is how God created you, that God created you with this particular way of seeing the world and this particular desire. And because you're gay, that must mean there's something wrong with you. So how would you respond to that? I'm not saying I believe that.
Let's unpack it a little bit. So Christians often have said, are you born gay or do you choose to be gay? And most Christians, say 10 or 20 years ago, said you choose to be gay. However, that doesn't really fit our theology, because most people who believe the Bible believe that all people are born in sin, that we're born sinners, and that's right from birth. And yet we don't all have proclivities or inclinations toward all sins equally. I tend to be more prone toward pride, and my wife Tamara tends to be more prone toward anxiety. So wouldn't it make sense that someone from birth would have an orientation toward being gay, in addition to all kinds of other orientations people might have? So I think people, the evidence scientifically is mixed on is somebody born gay. Mm-hmm. There's some evidence for, some evidence against. But biblically, theologically, we would expect people to be born with some sinful inclination or another, which then raises the question people ask in this conversation, is being gay part of creation or the fall? Mm-hmm. Were people created that way, or is it a fallen condition? Is it something sinful in and of itself? So we established that a temptation is not sinful. However, the temptation itself, if acted on, is sinful. So to be tempted, if you're tempted to lie, that's not sin. But if you lie, that's sin. So the temptation to lie itself is not like a positive desire.
Yeah.
So the temptation or the attraction to have sex with somebody of my same sex, man with a man, woman with a woman, is itself not healthy. Is itself not godly. It's not a desire you would want to fulfill. However, as I talk to folks who are gay, they say being gay is way more than that. Mm-hmm. Like being gay is about my being an artist. It's about the way I relate to the world. It's about my enjoyment of friendships with people of my same sex. I don't go around all the time like
wanting to have sex with every...
Right.
Just the same way if you're straight, you don't want to have sex with every woman you see or every man you see. You know?
Right. Yeah. And so On that level, again, it begs the question, what is it to be gay? What does it mean to be gay?
Right, we're back to where we started.
But if it's a broader phenomena than merely sexual, or let's isolate the sexual, the desire to have sex with someone of my same sex is itself unhealthy, and if acted on in lust or behavior, is sinful.
Okay.
However, if there's a broader phenomena, which let's say, let me give a different one. I'm a driven person. You know that? No question about it. Is being driven sinful? Well, probably not, but it can be. Like, I could run over people, and that would be sinful, or it could lead to arrogance. That'd be sinful. But being driven in and of itself can actually be used for good. It could lead to being zealous for the Lord.
Yeah, and I think the key to your sort of redemption story here is also that singleness should be valued. So, because basically what you're saying is, if you boil it down, is if you have attractions to someone of the same sex and you only have attractions to someone of the same sex, your only choice is to be celibate. If you cannot enter into a union with someone
That's
of the
right.
opposite
so
sex.
If we have a distorted view of sexuality, that it's absolutely essential for a good life, and if we have a distorted view of singleness, that it's a bad choice, a not good choice for life, then we're saying
a sad state of affairs.
It's sad. Sad that you're single and you couldn't find somebody.
Yeah.
Then what we're saying to a gay person is, oh my goodness, you have to be single and celibate all your life. What a terrible, tragic life.
Yeah.
And what that betrays is a poor theology of singleness and a poor theology of sex, an overvaluing of sex and an undervaluing of singleness, which undermines our ability to offer a flourishing life to a celibate gay Christian person who wants to live a life honoring to Christ.
Yeah, it also, and I think our culture does this, and the church has done this as well, we don't value friendship enough.
That's right.
And so we don't look to other relationships. We look to our spouse to be our best friend, to complete us, all the language that you hear in the movies.
Right. And yet, ironically, Jesus said, the greatest love is this, that a person lay down his life, oh, not for his spouse,
yeah,
but for his friend.
Yeah. And then he looks on his disciples as his family.
And so we can have rich community. We can have deep relationships. We can have intimacy without being married.
Yeah. So singleness is not saying you're now forced to be lonely.
There are plenty of married people who are lonely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the other thing that you can say is, look, yes, desires for someone of the same sex, you're saying, should not be fulfilled, but lots of sexual desires should not be fulfilled.
That's exactly right.
And sexual desires that straight people have.
That's exactly right.
Should not be fulfilled. So we're all, it's just that our culture makes it so that if you're not in a romantic relationship, it's like you're not living.
Right.
And that's, that kind of messaging is damaging to people. And that's hard. And so I think for people who are talking to someone, maybe your child, maybe your, you know, aunt, uncle, maybe a friend who's come out to you and said, I am same sex, you know, I'm gay, I'm same sex attracted. It's the only person I want to be with is someone of my same sex. I think the kind of language that Bruce has given you can be really helpful to relate to them and to say, this is not saying that your life is over, or that I'm saying, because I don't think it's God's design for you to be married to someone of the same sex, that means your life is not worth living.
That's right. And to paint what Christ came to offer for all of us is an abundant life, a rich life, a wonderful life. That is the case for all of us. We can all live an amazing life in union with Christ, married or single, but particularly in this conversation, a rich, wonderful life. Let's say, did Jesus have a wonderful life? Did he live a good life? Yes, of course. He was single and he never had sex. And so someone who's single and never have sex actually has more common with the way Jesus lived his life.
Yeah.
On that level.
Yeah, that's helpful. All right, well, that's another episode.
Okay.
That we've done.
Are we doing another one?
If we have time.
Oh, sure. We'll do one more.
We'll do one more. All right, everybody. Well, thank you so much for listening. We will see you back next week.